Whether because the green trees reminded me of the Druma, or because the hut reminded me of my days with the woman I now knew to be my mother, I felt curious to learn more. I looked down. "You can wait here for me if you want. I'm going closer." Shim watched me depart, swearing under his breath. A few seconds later, he trotted to catch up to me. As he approached, I stopped and turned to him.
"Smelled some honey, did you?"
he growled.
"Goblins is more likely."
Nervously, he glanced over his shoulder.
"But even if no goblins is are there, they is not far away."
"You can be sure of that. We won't stop long, I promise. Just long enough to see who lives there." As we neared the orchard, I discerned a rough stone wall bordering the trees. It was made of the same gray rock, splotched with rust-colored lichen, as the hut. Judging from the gaps and toppled portions of both, neither hut nor wall had been repaired in quite some time. Just as the crumbling wall embraced the trees themselves embraced the hut, flowing over its roof and sides with leafy branches. Beneath the boughs, several beds of green speckled with brighter colors thatched the ground. I crouched, as did Shim. Cautiously, we crept closer. A fresh aroma wafted over us, the scent of wet leaves and newborn blossoms. It struck me how long it had been since I smelled the fragrance of living, growing plants. And then it struck me that this was not just an orchard, this was a garden. Just then a pair of shapes, as gray as the stones in the wall, emerged from the hut. Taking wobbly steps, the pair slowly advanced toward the nearest bed of plants. They moved with an odd, disjointed rhythm, one back straightening as the other curved, one head lifting as the other drooped. As different as their motions were, however, they seemed unalterably connected. As they came nearer, I could tell that these two people were old, very old. White hair, streaked with gray, fell about both of their shoulders, while their sleeveless brown robes hung worn and faded. Had their backs not been so bent, they would have stood quite tall. Only their arms, muscular and brown, seemed younger than their years. The pair reached the first bed of plants, then separated. One of them, a woman, whose strong cheekbones reminded me of my mother, stooped to retrieve a sack of seeds and started working them into the soil on one side of the hut. At the same time, the other, a man with a long banner of whiskers waving from his chin, picked up a basket and hobbled toward a tree laden with the same spiral fruit that I had tasted at the Shamora tree. Abruptly, the old man halted. He turned slowly toward the spot where we crouched behind the wall. Without taking his eyes off us, he spoke in a low, crusty voice.
"Garlatha, we have visitors."
The old woman looked up. Though her face creased with concern, she answered calmly in a voice that creaked with age,
"Then let them show themselves, for they have nothing to fear."
"I am T'Ailin," declared the man. "If you come in peace, you are welcome here."
Slowly we lifted our heads. I stood up and planted my staff on the ground. As my hand brushed over the place that had been raked by teeth only hours before, a chill passed through me. Meanwhile, Shim rose beside me and squared his shoulders, although only his eyes and frantic hair poked above the top of the wall.
"We come in peace."
"And what are your names?"
Feeling cautious, I hesitated.
"Our names is secret,"
declared Shim.
"Nobody knows them."
For good measure, he added,
"Not even us."
One corner of T'Ailin's mouth curled upward.
"You are right to be cautious, little traveler. But as my wife has said, you have nothing to fear from us. We are simple gardeners, that is all."
I stepped across the wall, trying not to crush the slender yellow vegetables growing from a vine on the other side. I offered a hand to Shim, who pushed it aside and climbed over the jumble of rocks unaided. T'Ailin's expression became serious again.
"These are dangerous times to travel in Fincaira. You must be either very brave or very foolish.
I nodded. Time will tell which we are. But may I ask about you? If it's dangerous to travel here, it must be more so to live here.
Too true.
Ta'ilin beckoned to Garlatha to join him.
But where could we go? My wife and I have lived here together for 68 years. Our roots are deep as these trees.
With a wave at their unadorned home, he added,
Besides, we have no treasure.
Not that could be stolen, that is.
Garlatha took his arm, smiling at him.
Our treasure is too big for any chest, and more precious than any jewels.
Ta'ilin nodded.
You are right, my lady.
Leaning toward me, he grinned mischievously.
She is always right, even when she is wrong.
Garlatha kicked him hard in the shin.
Ow!
He howled, rubbing the spot.
After 68 years, you should have learned some manners. After 68 years, I have learned to see right through you.
Garlatha looked at him full in the face. Slowly, she grinned.
Yet somehow I still like what I see.
The old man's dark eyes glittered.
Come now, what of our guests? Can we offer you a place to sit, anything to eat?
I shook my head. We have no time for sitting, I'm afraid. I pointed toward the spiral-shaped fruits dangling from the branch. I would take one of those, though. I had that kind once before, and it was wonderful. Ta'ilin reached up and with surprising dexterity plucked one of the fruits with his large, wrinkled hand. As he gave it to me, he said,
You may certainly have this, but you have not had its kind, the larkin, before.
Puzzled, I shook my head.
These grow nowhere else in Fincaira,
explained the gardener, his voice solemn.
Years ago, long before you were born, trees bearing them dotted the hills east of the river unceasing, but they have succumbed to the blight that has afflicted the rest of our land. All but this one.
I took a bite of the fruit. The flavor, like purple sunshine, burst inside my mouth. There is one other place this fruit still grows, and there I have eaten it before. In unison, Ta'ilin and Garlatha asked,
Where?
In Druma Wood, at the Shamora tree.
The Shamora?
Sputtered Garlatha.
You have truly been there, to the rarest of trees?
A friend who knows it well took me there. Ta'ilin stroked his wispy beard.
If that is true, you have a remarkable friend.
My face tightened. I do. A slight breeze stirred the branch above me, rustling the living leaves. I listened for a moment. I felt like a man deprived of water for days who finally heard the sound of a burbling stream. Suddenly, Shim reached up and yanked the spiral fruit from my hand. Before I could protest, he took two large bites. I glared at him.
Don't you know how to ask?
said the little giant through a mouthful of fruit. Garlatha's eyes shone with amusement. Turning to her husband, she said,
It appears that I am not the only one without manners.
You are right, he answered.
Hobbling a few steps away, he added with equal amusement,
As always.
Garlatha grinned. Her strong arm reached up to the branch, picked another spiral fruit, and handed it to me.
Here, you can start again.
You are most generous, especially if this is the last tree of this kind east of the Druma. I sniffed the larkin's zesty fragrance, then took a bite. Once again, my tongue exploded with sunny flavor. Savoring the taste, I asked, How has your garden survived so well in the midst of this blight? It's a miracle. The couple traded glances. Ta'ilin's face hardened.
It is no more of a miracle than all of these lands once were, but our wicked king has changed all that.
It has broken our hearts to watch,
said Garlatha, her voice cracking.
Stangmar's shroud blocks out the sun, continued the old man. More with each passing month. For as the shrouded castle grows in power, the sky grows ever darker. Meanwhile, his armies have sown death across the land. Whole villages have been destroyed. People have fled to the mountains far to the west, or left Finnkaidr altogether. A vast forest, as remarkable as Druma Wood, once grew on those hills to the east, no more. What trees have not been slaughtered or burned have retreated into slumber, never to speak again. Here on the plains, what soil has not been soaked with blood has taken on its very color, and the flowering harp that could perhaps coax the land back to life has been stolen from us. He looked down at his weathered hands. I carried the harp only once when I was just a boy. But after all these years, I still cannot forget the feel of its strings, nor the thrill of its melody. He grimaced. All that and more is lost. He motioned toward the cleft in the hill behind the hut. See our once joyous spring, hardly a trickle. As the land has withered, so has the water that nourished it. Half of my day I now spend hauling water from afar. Garlatha took his hand. As I spend half of mine searching the dry prairie for seeds that still may be revived. Awkwardly, Shim offered to her the remains of his fruit.
I am sorry for you.
Garlatha patted his unruly head.
Keep the fruit now, and do not feel sorry for us. We are far more fortunate than most.
That we are, agreed her husband. We have been granted a long life together, and a chance to grow a few trees. That is all anyone could ask for. He glanced at her. That, and our one remaining wish, that one day we might die together.
Like Boceas and Philemon, I observed.
Who?
Boceas and Philemon. They are characters in a story from the Greeks, a story I learned from my mother, long ago. They had but one wish, to die together, and in the end the gods turned them into a pair of trees whose leafy branches would wrap around each other for all time.
How beautiful!
Garlatha sighed, looking at her husband. Tylan said nothing, though he studied me closely.
But you have not told me, I continued, how your garden has survived in this terrible time.
Ta'ilin released Garlatha's hand and opened his sinewy arms to the greenery, the roots, the blossoms surrounding them. We have loved our garden, that is all. I nodded, thinking how wondrous this region must have been before the blight. If the garden where Shim and I now stood was only a small sampling of its riches, the landscape would have been as beautiful, though not as wild and mysterious, as the Druma itself. The kind of place where I would have felt alive and free, and possibly even at home. Garlatha observed us worriedly.
Are you certain you cannot rest here for a while?
No, we cannot.
Then you must be extremely careful, warned Ta'ilin. Goblins are everywhere these days. Only yesterday at sunset, when I was coming back with water, I saw a pair of them. They were dragging away a helpless girl.
My heart stopped. A girl? What did she look like?
The white-bearded man looked pained.
I could not get very close, or they would have seen me. Yet, while I watched, part of me wanted to attack them with all my strength.
I am glad you did not,
declared his wife.
Ta'ilin pointed at me.
The girl was about your age, long, curly brown hair, and she wore a suit that seemed to be made of woven vines.
Shim and I gasped. Rhea, I whispered hoarsely, where were they going?
There can be no doubt, the old man answered dismally. They were traveling east, and since the girl was alive at all, she must be someone Stangmar wants to deal with personally.
Garlatha moaned.
I cannot bear the thought of a young girl at that terrible castle.
I felt for the dagger in my satchel. We must go now. Tylan extended his hand to me, clasping my own with unexpected firmness.
I do not know who you are, young man, nor where you are going, but I suspect that, like one of our seeds, you hold much more within than you show without.
Garlatha touched Shim's head again.
The same, I think, could be said for this little fellow.
I did not reply, although I wondered whether they would have spoken so kindly to us if they had known us better. Even so, as I crossed over the crumbling wall, I found myself hoping that I might one day see them again. I turned to wave to the elderly couple. They waved back, then resumed their work. I noticed that the Galator felt warm against my chest. Peeking under my tunic, I saw that its jeweled center was glowing ever so slightly. And I knew that Caer Pray's theory about the Galator was true. Chapter 31. Then came a scream. For several hours we trekked toward the notch in the ridge, my staff rhythmically punching the dry soil and dead grass. A cold wind out of the dark hills blew down on us. Its bitter gusts slapped our faces. Despite the wind, Shim did his best to stay by my side. Even so, I had to stop several times to help him through some thorny bracken or up a steep pitch. As the land sloped increasingly upward, the wind blew ever more fiercely. Soon it smacked with such piercing cold that my hand holding my staff no longer pulsed with pain, but started to go numb. It felt as wooden as the staff itself. Flying bits of ice began to whip against us. I lifted my free arm to protect my cheeks and sightless eyes. The bits of ice turned into needles, then shards, then daggers. As the icy blades rained down on us, Shim, who had resisted complaining since leaving the garden, whined piteously. But I could only hear him in the lulls between gusts, for the howling of the wind grew fiercer. Although it remained light enough for my second sight to help, the swirling ice and blowing dirt confused my sense of direction. Suddenly I stumbled against a low, flat outcropping of some sort. With a cry, I crumpled to the ground, dropping my staff. Shivering, I crawled over to the outcropping, hoping to use it as a slight shelter against the storm. Shim tucked himself into the folds of my tunic. We sat there, our teeth chattering from the cold, for minutes that seemed like weeks. In time, the ice storm abated. The howling wind hurled itself at us a few last times, then finally retreated. Although the air seemed no warmer, our bodies slowly revived. I opened and closed my hands, which made my palms and fingertips sting. Hesitantly, Shim poked his head out of my tunic, his wild hair embedded with icicles. All at once, I realized that the outcropping that had partially shielded us was nothing more than an immense tree stump. All around us, thousands of such stumps littered the hills, separated by a vast web of eroded gullies. Though frosted with a glaze of ice, the stumps did not sparkle or gleam. They merely sat there, as lifeless as burial mounds. In a flash, I understood. This was all that remained of the vast forest that T'Ailin had described. Stangmar's armies have sown death across the land. The old man's words lifted like ghosts out of the rotting stumps, the blood-red soil, the broken hills. Shim and I looked at each other. Without a word, we stood up on the frosted ground. I picked up my staff, knocking a chunk of ice off the top. Then I located the notch again, stepped over the brittle remains of a branch, and started up the slippery terrain. Shim scrambled to stay with me, muttering under his breath. As the day wore on, we continued to climb, over hills scarred with countless stumps and dry stream beds. All the while, the sky grew darker. Soon the notch disappeared, swallowed in the deepening darkness. I could only trust my memory of where I had last glimpsed its two sharp knobs, though that memory itself was fading with the light. Slowly we gained elevation. Despite the dim light, I detected a few thin trees rising amidst the stumps and dead branches. Their twisted forms resembled people writhing in pain. Seeing one tree wearing the bark of a beech, I approached it. Laying my hand on the trunk, I made the swishing, rustling sound that Rhea had taught me in Druma Wood. The tree did not respond. I tried again. This time, as I made the swishes, I imagined the living, breathing presence of a healthy tree before me, the powerful roots thrusting into the soil, the arching branches lifting toward the sky, the deep-throated song rising through the trunk, thrilling each and every leaf. Perhaps it was just my imagination, but I thought I could sense the barest beginnings of a quiver in the uppermost branches. Yet, if they had actually moved, they quickly fell still again. Giving up, I trudged on. Shim huffed at my heels. As we climbed the rising slope, the ground grew more rocky. With each passing minute, the light dimmed further. The sky blackened, while the stumps and rocks around us melted into shadows. Although my second sight was swiftly fading, I fought to see whatever I still could. And with all my concentration, I listened. I knew that any movement, no matter how slight, could provide our only warning of attack. As I tried to avoid tripping on rocks and snapping dead branches, my steps grew less certain. Ahead, I discerned a barely visible gap where twin knobs of dark rock lifted into the still darker sky. Might it be the notch? I edged closer as quietly as I could. Abruptly, I stopped. I stood as still as one of the twisted trees, listening. Shim crept to my side.
You hear something?
Not sure, I whispered. I thought I did, somewhere ahead of us. Minutes passed. I heard no sound apart from our breathing and the thumping of my own heart. Eventually, I touched the little giant's arm. Let's go, I whispered, but keep quiet. Goblins are near.
Ooh,
moaned Shim.
Are you scared? Certainly, definitely,
quiet! Out of the shadows ahead of us came a raspy cry and a sudden pounding of feet. Torches flared, searing the darkness. Goblins! Across the rocky ridge we fled. Dead branches snapped under our feet. Thorns ripped at our shins. I could hear, just behind, the heaving of the goblins' chests, the clanking of their armor, the sputtering of their torches. Shim and I tore across the rocks, trying not to stumble. Darkness pressed closer. We did not know where we were going, nor did we care. We only knew that the goblins were gaining on us. In a desperate effort to lose them, I veered sharply to one side. Shim followed closely, and we crossed over the ridge. The vista before us could not have been more chilling. Against the darkened sky, more hills loomed, even darker. Worse yet, the valley below us looked utterly black, but for the glint of hundreds of tiny lights, despite the goblins at our backs, we hesitated for an instant. A spear whizzed past, passing between my head and the top of my staff. Even as the spear clattered against the ground, to a chorus of raspy curses, we plunged down the slope. My foot struck a rock and I fell sprawling. Shim waited long enough for me to roll back to my feet, grab my staff, and resume running. We charged downward into the black valley. Total darkness swept over us like a wave. The ground became wet and mushy under our feet. The air turned rancid. Before long, we splashed through something like an enormous puddle covering a bed of oozing murk. All at once, I halted, causing Shim to run straight into my back.
"What is you stopping for?"
he demanded angrily.
"Listen.
I hears nothing except the throbbings of my tenderly nose."
"That's just it. The goblins stopped. Somewhere back there."
"You is right."
The little giant shifted nervously in the murk.
"Do you think they is scared to goes here?"
I felt something cold oozing into my leather boots.
"We may be in the haunted marsh."
As if in answer, a faint, wavering light appeared some distance away. It hovered in the darkness, seeming to examine us. Then another appeared, followed by another. Soon, more than 20 of the eerie lights swam around us, moving slowly closer. Shim squeezed my hand. A reeking smell like festering flesh drifted over us. I gagged, my lungs rebelling. As the lights drew nearer, the smell grew stronger. Then came a thin, unsteady wailing, an ancient dirge pulsing with anguish, with undying pain. The wailing made me cringe as it welled out of the ground, the lights, the rotting air. It came from one side, it came from the other, it came from every direction at once. Shim released a terrified shriek. Letting go of my hand, he dashed away from the cluster of floating lights.
Wait!
I hurled myself after him. I had only gone a few steps, however, when something caught my foot. I tumbled headlong into a puddle of slimy liquid. Pulling myself and my staff free, I shook the murk from my arms. They stunk of mold and decay. The ominous lights circled, gathering again. The wailing swelled. The stench of death flooded over me. Shim! No answer. Shim! Then came a scream. The lights pressed closer, staring down on me like so many eyes. So this was how my quest would end. I would have rather drowned in the sea off the coast of Gunid than die like this, wretched and alone. Yet the loss of my own quest pained me less than the loss of Rhea. She, like the brave Merlin, had given her life for me. I did not deserve such friendship. Yet she did not deserve to die. She was so full of life, so full of wisdom, that I did not begin to comprehend. The pain of losing her made my heart sting as if it were on fire. Suddenly I realized that the Galator was blazing with heat against my chest. I tore it out of my tunic and held it high. The jeweled center sparkled with its own green light, pushing back the darkness just enough that I could see my own hand and arm. The eerie lights faltered, stopped their advance. The wailing ceased. A touch of freshness wafted on the air. At the same time, the Galator's glow started to expand. In a few seconds, the circle of green illuminated my entire body as well as my staff.
Shim! Where are you?
Here!
Soaked in murk, he staggered to my side. His chest, legs, arms, and one side of his face dripped with black ooze. As the glowing circle expanded, the floating lights wavered, then slowly drew back into the darkness. The wailing resumed, but transformed into an angry murmur. Heartened by the retreat of the lights, I pressed ahead. I would find some way out of this swamp, whatever it took. Holding the Galator above my head with one hand, grasping my staff with the other, I made sure Shim held tight to my tunic. Then I started to trudge through the marshy pools. The mud was soft and sticky, sucking at my boots. Suddenly I stepped into a shallow pit. I fell forward with a splash, almost dropping the pendant. Instantly, the eyes of light crowded closer, and the murmur swelled louder. As I regained my balance, the menacing lights pulled back a little. It took me a moment to extract my staff from the grasping mud of the pit, though it finally came free with a loud slurp. We slogged onward. I could tell, however, that Shim could not travel very far in this terrain. Although he was struggling to stay with me, the water was up to his waist, and the work of pushing through it was tiring him fast. My own legs, as well as the arm holding the Galator, began to feel increasingly heavy. Nevertheless, I helped Shim climb up to the shoulder of my arm holding the staff. It was the same shoulder that Trouble had once claimed as his perch. But this load felt much heavier than the hawk ever did. Each step grew more difficult, each breath more labored. I felt weaker and weaker, as if the marsh itself was sapping my strength. My shoulder ached. The murk from Shim's legs dripped onto my face while the rancid taste burned my tongue. As my stamina faded, the lights pressed ever closer. The murmur swelled like a pack of wolves howling in my ears. The marsh seemed endless, stretching far beyond the limits of my flagging endurance. My powers! Should I try to use them? I needed them so much, yet I feared them so much. The flames rose again in my mind, snapping at my face, searing my flesh, scorching my eyes. Suddenly I stumbled. I fell to my knees, barely hanging on to both my staff and the Galator. Shim gave a shout and clung to my neck, sobbing. Again the lights crowded around, waiting to see if I would rise again. With all my remaining strength, I pushed myself out of the slime. I tried to lift the Galator, but could not bring it higher than my chest. I took another exhausted step and stumbled again. I heard the Galator smack against something hard like stone. I heard Shim scream as the murmur grew almost deafening. Then I heard no more. Chapter 32, Dark Fate.
Is you alive?
Not sure, was my only answer. I sat up and shook the fog from my second sight. Shim sat on one side, while my staff, caked with rancid-smelling mud, lay on the other. Shim, his small face lined with worry, pulled on my tunic.
Where is we?
Surveying our surroundings, I took in the strangest room I had ever seen. Polished stone walls, floor and ceiling enclosed us without even a slit for a window. Yet a quivering blue light filled the room, like the light from a candle just before it burns out. But no candle could be seen. I shivered, though not from cold. I could not be certain why, but a feeling of foreboding hung in the air, as if Shim and I were about to be sliced up for someone's supper. Shim slid closer.
This place is frighteningly like a dungeon.
I agree. Suddenly he pointed.
Bones!
With a start, I viewed the shadowy pile next to us. It was indeed a mass of bones, picked perfectly clean. In the quivering light, I could make out ribs, leg bones, and more than a few skulls. People's skulls. I swallowed, wondering whether our own remains would soon rest there. Then I noticed that several other piles, though not of bones, surrounded us. One held thin slabs of gray stone, stacked almost as tall as my staff. Another contained polished balls of wood carved in varied sizes and etched with strange signs. Some smaller than fingernails and others larger than heads, the balls seemed to have been carefully arranged for some purpose. Still another pile contained bundles of sticks, sorted by size as well as number. In the far corner of the room, I noticed strange white cubes marked with black dots on their sides. Spools of black and white yarn were piled here, bizarre shells from the sea there. Iron bowls overflowed with pebbles and seeds of many shapes. In the middle of the floor sat a thick square rug that was divided into smaller red and black squares. On many of these squares stood carved wooden pieces, each of them about as high as my waist. Attacking dragons, galloping horses, howling wolves, warring goblins, kings and queens, plus others I could not begin to recognize. Back in Caer Vedwood, I had heard of the game called Aeschys, sometimes shortened to chess. But that game was played on a board, not a rug, and in any event, chess pieces did not include dragons or goblins. On the stone wall opposite us, a dense jumble of blue markings wavered in the light. Columns of slashes, dots, and squiggles running in several directions covered much of the surface. There were thousands of squares, triangles, and meshes of crossed lines, as well as circles divided into sections much as a round loaf of bread is sliced. There were runes, letters, numbers, and symbols squeezed over and under, inside and outside the rest of the markings.
Too bad,
growled a deep voice behind us. We spun around to see a pale, hairless head poking through the crack of a door. Slowly, the door swung open, revealing a body as round as the head, wearing a robe resembling a cloth sack with several pockets, a necklace of rough stones, and bare feet. I froze, fearful that this was another shifting wraith, or perhaps something worse. The hairless head, with rows of wrinkles gathering about two triangular ears, leaned toward us. One large, shriveled wart sprouted like a horn from the middle of the forehead. Eyes even blacker than my own watched us, unblinking, for several seconds. Then the mouth full of misshapen teeth opened again.
Definitely too bad.
Reaching for my staff, I scrambled to my feet, which was made more difficult by Shim's clinging to my leg. Who are you?
Almost no chance they'll live out the day, muttered the strange figure, entering the room. Definitely too bad.
Though my voice quaked, I repeated my question. Who are you? The black eyes, seeming terribly old, observed me for a moment.
That's a difficult question, my pet.
Something about the words, my pet, made me cringe.
Who am I?
Continued the creature, pacing slowly around us like a vulture examining its carrion.
Hard to tell, even for me. Today I'm someone, tomorrow someone else.
The wrinkled face bent toward me, showing more crooked teeth.
And who are you?
I gave a sigh. The truth is, I'm not really sure.
At least, my pet, you are honest.
The circling continued, the bare feet slapping on the stone floor.
Perhaps I can tell you a bit about who you are. Though I should warn you, it's rather disappointing. For starters, you are too skinny to provide more than a mouthful or two, even with your little friend thrown in.
Shim squeezed my leg harder.
Worse still, my pet. You look far too weak to be of any help to my wager, and I do so detest losing.
An icy finger ran down my spine. I know who you are. You are Donnu.
Very clever, my pet.
The hairless hag stopped circling. She ran a hand across the top of her head, ruminating.
But cleverness won't be enough to win my wager.
What wager are you talking about?
Oh, nothing of any importance. I merely made a little wager with someone who expects you not to survive until tomorrow.
She shrugged.
Die today, die tomorrow. What difference does it make? I should not have bet on you, but I could not resist the odds.
I shuddered, remembering what Carepray had said about this being whose name means dark fate. Neither good nor evil, friend nor foe, she simply is. Who did you wager against? Domnu's bare feet slapped across the stone floor as she moved to the wall covered with strange markings, still trembling in the unsteady light. She spat on the index finger of her left hand, which immediately turned blue. Then, using the finger as a paintbrush, she stretched to reach as high as she could and drew a squiggly line through one of the circles.
Time to start using a new wall, she grumbled.
With a glance in our direction, she added,
Must keep score, my pets. I do dislike losing a wager, but I must keep score, and it certainly does look like I will lose this one.
You mean,
piped Shim,
that we is going to die?
Domnu shrugged again.
It certainly looks that way.
I demanded, Who did you wager against?
No one you know, although he does seem to have developed a genuine dislike for you.
Who? She scratched the back of her bald head.
That fool Rita Gower, of course.
Rita Gower? The spirit-battling Dagda?
Domnu grunted carelessly.
I suppose so. At least it was so a few thousand years ago when last I checked. But as to who is winning and who is losing, my pet, I have no idea. They must keep their own tallies.
But it's not a game. It's serious.
Domnu stiffened.
Games are serious, my pet. As serious as life itself. For that, too, is just a game.
You don't understand.
I stepped closer with Shim still holding tight to my leg.
Their battle is for all of Finkaira, as well as the earth, and more beyond that.
Yes, yes, said the hag, yawning. They have an ongoing wager.
No, it's more than that.
She stared at me, dumbfounded.
More than that? How can anything be more than that? A wager is the purest chance of all. Make your choice. Place your bet. Then whatever happens, happens. Up or down, life or death. It doesn't matter, as long as you collect your winnings in the end.
I shook my head.
It does matter. Whether Dagda or Rita Gower wins will determine
what the odds will be on their next wager. Yes, I know.
Domnu's feet slapped over to the rug of red and white squares. She bent low to face one of the pieces, the figure of a red dragon. Nonchalantly, she tickled under its scaly chin. In the quivering light, I could not be sure, but it almost seemed that the dragon's head jerked slightly, and that two thin trails of smoke drifted out of its nostrils.
"Their little game is of no interest to me," she concluded, even as she gave the dragon's ear a tweak. "I have enough trouble keeping track of my own."
Shim clutched tighter.
"Are you scared? Very, very, very scared?"
"I don't know why you should be," replied Damnu with a crooked grin. "Dying isn't so bad after the first time."
She placed her foot on the back of the dragon piece, reached for the figure of the Black King, and grabbed it roughly by the neck. I could have been mistaken, but as she lifted the king off the rug, I thought I heard a faint, anguished squeal. Still grasping the neck, she began polishing the king's crown on her sack-like robe.
"I suppose we should play a game of some kind before I send you on your way, my pets. It will take our minds off your impending deaths and my impending loss. Do you prefer dice or sticks?"
"We need your help," I pleaded. She replaced the Black King, dropping the piece with a thud. Then, feet slapping on the floor, she ambled over to the pile of sticks. She plucked a small bundle from the pile and contemplated it.
"I think 3s would be better than 13s today, don't you? I have the feeling in my bones that this is a low number day." "Bones! Perhaps you would rather play bones."
"Please! We need to get to the Shrouded Castle."
"The Shrouded Castle?"
She pulled a stick from the bundle and spat on it.
"Why ever would you want to go there?"
"A goodly question,"
muttered Shim, hugging my shin.
"Besides," Damnu continued, all the while examining the stick, "if I send you there, then you will certainly die, and I will lose my wager."
"Won't you please help us?"
"I am afraid not, my pet."
She twirled the stick in the palm of her hand. I scowled.
"If you're not going to help us, then why don't you just put us back in the haunted marsh and get it over with?"
Shim looked up at me with amazement.
"I may well, my pet. After all, I did promise Rita Gower that I would not keep you safe here all day. Rules of the wager, you understand, and I never break the rules."
She lowered her voice.
"Besides, he would notice if I did."
She inserted the stick back into the bundle, then tossed it carelessly onto the pile.
"But why the hurry? We still have time for a game or two."
"We do not have time," I exclaimed. "Isn't there any way we can convince you?"
"The only question," she went on, scanning the room, "is which game to choose." "Of course, chess. Though I don't suppose you know anything about the rules, young as you are. No matter. Just come over here, and I will teach you a bit. And bring that brave warrior there, the one clinging to your leg."
She walked back over to the rug and glanced around at the chess pieces.
"Too tall, I think."
With an expression of concentration, she placed the palm of her hand on the crown of the Red Queen. She muttered a phrase softly, then began to press slowly downward. To my astonishment, the Red Queen, as well as all the other chess pieces, grew steadily smaller, until they were only half of their original size. Now the tallest pieces were about the same height as Shim. Proudly, Damnu waved at the chess pieces.
"It really is one of my better inventions, this game. A great success wherever it goes. Even the humans, with their limited powers of concentration, have adopted it, though it grieves me to see how they try to oversimplify the rules of the game. The only drawback is that it is best played with 2 people, and finding the right partner can be very difficult indeed."
Raising her thin eyebrows, she sent waves of wrinkles across the top of her scalp.
"Especially if you have as few visitors as I do. By the way, most of my visitors come by the front door. Whatever possessed you to use the back door? I might never have found you if you hadn't knocked on the doorstep."
"I didn't knock."
"Of course you did. Though I almost didn't hear you with that awful din outside."
"But I didn't knock."
"My pet, you are forgetful. You knocked with something hard. It must have been your head. Or perhaps that unattractive little pendant of yours.
Suddenly remembering the Galator, I clutched it tightly. It was no longer glowing. Swiftly, I replaced it under my tunic.
I might have left you there, but I haven't had any company for games in so long, 2 centuries at least. Then, after I brought you in, I realized you must be the ones Rita Gower had wagered would not survive the day if you should ever turn up here.
Her ancient eyes narrowed.
I only wish I had seen you before I agreed to the wager.
Damnu started pacing around the rug, inspecting each of the chess pieces carefully. Although the wavering light made the whole room seem to vibrate, it struck me that each of the chess pieces trembled slightly as she approached. Then, when she passed in back of a gallant-looking black stallion, the horse seemed to shift its hind leg ever so slightly. Instantly, Damnu whirled around.
You wouldn't be wanting to kick me now, would you?
The black eyes flashed as she ran her finger slowly down the horse's mane.
No, your manners are better than that. Much better. You must be wanting a bit more weight on your back. Yes, I am certain that's it.
The barest whinny seemed to come from the stallion, its carved muscles almost tensed. Damnu bent over it and blew a long, gentle breath. Out of nowhere, a rough black stone, half the size of the horse itself, appeared on the middle of its back. While the stallion seemed to sag under the weight, it continued to hold its head high.
"There now," declared Damnu. "That's much better."
She spun to face me.
"Time for a little game of chess," she said in a voice more threatening than inviting. "Before I return you to your, shall we say, friends waiting outside, you make the first move."